You are listening to Eastside Radio Podcast.
Listen to Blow here on Eastside Radio with Dan Barnett, Matt McMahon, and we now have a very special guest in the studio with us, Jacob Collier. Jacob, welcome to the program.
Good to see you.
It's great to meet you, and welcome to Australia. And
thanks very much.
You've been here a few times, right?
A few times now, yeah. But there's always something very special about coming here.
What do you find special about Australia?
It's hard to say. I mean, for one, the seasons being flipped upside down is a little unnerving, but it's also somewhat delightful. I wasn't expecting the autumn to hit me this hard, but here we are. There's something just special about the energy of the people, I think. And I found ever since I first came here in 2018 to make music and play shows, there's something quite electric about just the spirit of openness and musicality and fearlessness. It's a good vibe.
Do you get out to hear many musicians while you're here?
I wish I had more time to wiggle around, you know, but you know, so many people I look up to come from here. I mean, one of my favorite bands ever is Hiatus Coyote, for example, and they're based in Melbourne. I love the whole scene.
Oh, great. Well, we do a sort of a jazz-influenced music show here on Blow, and I guess Matt's probably got a few music questions for you.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah.
Very good.
Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, well, I mean, so many of my students, they're the ones that introduced me to you a few years ago. And, of course, the question was, what are those chords Jacob's playing? You know, and I said, look, I have to see how to try and work them out too. They're flying by pretty quick. But it's been amazing for you to be so associated with kind of music theory, isn't it? As an artist traveling around doing your shows, but that's become part of your thing, isn't it?
In some ways, it has. It's funny. Never something I saw coming. But I've always been a total harmony fiend. You just love climbing inside, not just chords, but you know, notes and melodies and rhythms and all such things. And I think as a child, I had such a keen kind of emotional compass for musical choices, and just found myself very delighted by some of the more bizarre, interesting, illegal harmonic decisions that I heard made in music that I was listening to. And so I always just found it interesting to not only make those decisions and try and stretch the language as far as I could, but also to speak about it, because I think it's an abstract thing to think about, but it's an important thing to kind of discuss and describe too.
I'm really interested in your kind of ear training, because we know you have perfect pitch, and I know you've talked about learning and your mother introducing perfect pitch games and
stuff.
So not everyone has that kind of childhood.
It's true. I it was an interesting forgery I found between the things I was hearing and then the things I was feeling. My mother, who's just an incredible being, she also has perfect pitch, and so I think she encouraged me to kind of listen from my heart rather than just from my brain. But I was very much tickled when I really climbed inside some of the more crazy chords and things like that. Just the kind of like inner, like explosions, like sort of like in imaginatory particle collisions that happened. But I was quite familiar with all the notes by the time I got to that stage, you know.
Yes, that's kind of what I'm interested in. When you might have heard chords, were you able to pick the notes out pretty quickly early on?
I'd say so. Yeah. And I was just so interested by how, you know, one note could mean something so different in two different chords, you know. So you take a chord of A major, and the note D sharp in that chord is really spicy, but then in the chord of, you could say, like C minor, that same note is much less spicy, you know. So I was very interested by the power that these notes held in chords to make you feel stuff.
Yeah, and obviously a really interesting part of what you've done over the last few years is really incorporate microtonal kind of movements in a more systematic way than other people probably have.
Yeah,
tell me about that.
I at a certain point it became very clear to me that there were notes between the notes, and I felt like a sort of adventure in space or something. I thought there must be a way to access these notes, not just in a token way, but in a deeply kind of musical way. And so I actually kind of started to write songs in those sort of keys that don't exist, you know, keys between the cracks. But the art of it is not just to go there, but it's to get there in a way that feels kind of inevitable or natural.
Yes.
Because obviously some people use microtones in ways that just feel very dissonant and very, very sort of off-kilter. But I think they can be absolutely beautiful, especially if they're based in physics. You know, if you take a look at the harmonic series of every note that exists in the world, there are what we call a series of overtones. And those overtones sort of cut into much finer degrees of separation than just the ordinary notes that we find on the piano or on the guitar. So I found that by harnessing some of those relationships that feel very natural, you can actually swing into some of those, I call them cross-terrain keys, where there's all sorts of other things to be found.
And of course, because Like especially your early work was so much your own work, wasn't it? Solo, yeah, in every respect.
Yes, yes.
And you were free to explore these things in that context, which probably a lot of musicians would not be able to follow you on this particular journey.
I'm not sure they'd be even interested to. some of these experiments are quite sort of personal solo missions, but I think the exciting thing about that time in my life was expanding to the absolute furthest I could think to go, the deepest I could think to go into some of these concepts. And then when I stepped out of the room, as it were, and into the bigger world as a collaborator, and I've now collaborated with so many different kinds of musicians all over the world, I had the equipment to understand to the point that I'd gone how to navigate some of these musical ideas, and I was very grateful for that.
Very interesting.
I'm interested to know what when you're doing you cover so many different types of music. What's the thing that really floats your boat? Is there one particular thing or not? Just music in general.
It's so capacious is a word I love to use. You can kind of, nothing in life is beyond description in music, but I think you have to look across the plethora of options to really get a sense of what exists. Because I remember being about 14, 15 years old, and someone said, "Hey, Jacob, what genre do you like?" And I was befuddled by this question. So I thought, well, why must I choose one? I feel there are things you can only learn from listening to Renaissance classical music, and things you can only learn from listening to rock and roll, or only learn from listening to Indian classical music, or to improvised free jazz or whatever. And so I found myself at this sort of crossroads of sorts. And I thought, well, the most natural thing to me feels like to incorporate all these things that I love. And I wondered if at one point I'd want to narrow the path, and I haven't reached that day yet.
Because everybody tries to put you into a box. Everybody tries to put everybody into a box.
It's one of the things that humans like to do.
Yeah,
for sure.
So what was your impression when you first heard someone like Herbie Hancock? What was that?
Oh, wow. I mean, Herbie is not just a master of harmony and of notes, but also of time. He's such a funky man. And of sounds. I think he was the second person to ever play a synthesizer. And I've asked him about this, and he has most crazy stories, how that language of sound and the modulations and the oscillators, how it evolved and how he actually helped to sculpt that journey. And actually, another dear friend of mine, Quincy Jones, was the guy who asked the first synthesizer makers to put pitch wheels on so that they could bend the notes around. And it's just an amazing thing to hear those stories firsthand. But, I think Herbie really pioneered an attitude about how to use electronics within music, and he was one of the main bridges, I think, from this almost more cerebral outside music space to something that felt really soulful and really natural.
And you mentioned Hiatus Coyote before, but what are some of the other things that you're hearing at the moment in the world of music that you're liking?
Oh, so many. I've been really, really obsessed recently with the Bulgarian female choirs. I don't know if you guys have checked those out.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, they're so special. There's something so direct, so nasal, so extreme about the way they make music, which is amazing. Been really, really into Adrienne Lenker recently. I don't know if you know her. She's in a band called Big Thief. She's one of this generation's finest songwriters in my estimation. Listened to a bunch of Sly and the Family Stone in the last few days, because obviously Sly passed away. There's just so much depth in that music for me. I can't get over it. But one of the joys of being a music maker in 2025, but also a music lover, is that there's so much to consume, there's so much to adventure. If you're determined to find interesting music, there's just infinite things to discover and to chew on.
Something I find interesting about your, from what I can gather of your growth, I actually interviewed you briefly a few years ago on this station, and at the time you were talking about, your school experiences and how you, didn't find the musicians of your dreams, is the way you put it, which is partially why you ended up doing so much solo work. But it seems like, for me, not only have you incorporated so much, you're sort of beholden to no tradition, because most people would learn music and then they would go do a jazz gig and someone would say, "Don't play the Bill Evans Changes on this tune." There'd be kind of some gatekeepers kind of saying, "Well, this is the way you play flamenco," or "This in classical music, you must do the bow this way." But it seems like somehow you've managed to bypass all of that.
Right. Well, it's an interesting thing to think about. It's one of the things I'm most grateful for, is actually that my audience doesn't hold me to one thing. They don't think, "Oh, Jacob's definitely going to be the guy who does this or this or this or the other." I think I've been quite systematic about being unexpected to myself. I've always tried to surprise myself, and I think one of the secondhand results of that is that I've ended up being a bit hard to categorize, but I'm grateful for that. And I think a lot of other musicians I respect right now are in similar boats. I think there's something about embracing the whole of it and trying to render it in a way that feels natural and honest that has always done me well. And so it's something I'm always going to be determined to sort of try and enter into.
Do you think that's sort of hinting at a shift in, you know, the way people perceive musicians and music in general? They're trying to, you know, not, I mean, we've all, you know, we've got careers as musicians and you constantly, as I mentioned before, being put in a box. Do you think there's a shift happening?
Yeah, I do actually. I think there's a radical collaborative feeling about the world right now, and those who are open-minded and those who are fearless within it. I think that music is one of the best ways of that coming to the floor, coming to life. And so many people are listening in new ways and creating in new ways. And I also think, you know, as a storyteller in this day and age, you know, it's no longer just about, oh, I'm going to make a record, I'm going to go on tour. I mean, I love both those things, but there are so many other more deft ways of telling stories that go alongside that. You know, the whole of how we present our words and how we present ourselves in terms of the things that we wear and the things that we say and the things that we love. And now with social media, I think we're almost broadcasters of things that we care about and things that we love. So I think that, you know, I've really kind of lent into that as an artist over the years and have enjoyed those other ways of telling stories and the sort of culture that surrounds just the music itself. And I think in a way that's something that served me quite well.
Do you manage to get, when you're in your travels, get time away, you know, going and visiting people that I guess you wouldn't necessarily go and visit? Do you get to do some of that stuff?
Sometimes, yeah. It's normally quite hectic. You know, I've just come off a 3-week tour of Asia, and it was really just, you know, show day, fly day forever. And you know, but I always try to. It's the simple things that you forget to do, like go outside and drink water and things like to go to sleep, things like that. So I think if those bases are covered, then I tend to feel just like equipped to do my job, which is to, you know, provide a meaningful collective experience for a group of people. But it can be tough going to a place that I've heard so much about and being able to do like 30 minutes worth of exploration. But it's a real privilege to get to, you know, jump around the world in this crazy way.
You mentioned job. Does it feel like a job? I always say to people that being a musician, I feel like I've never worked a day in my life.
Well, yeah, I would always say I've maintained that attitude, but I think that the job that I feel I take very seriously is standing on a stage and really providing people with a way of connecting with each other. That's my task as a musician, and I say that with a lot of love and a huge amount of enjoyment. But I know when I've done that right, and the feeling that people get, I think, is of this real unity. And I do it in quite literal ways on the stage. You know, even the idea of the audience as a choir, you know, conducting the audience as a mass choir. I think the difference between the feeling of doing that and not doing that is, you know, one is of the audience thinking, oh, you know, Jacob's great and I like his music, and the other is of thinking, well, I did that. I'm part of something much bigger, and I'm one of the number. I think there's something really kind of philosophically profound about that I take very seriously, and I think it's a very important thing to do is to share that. But I don't take myself that seriously, if that makes sense. I take the work that all of us do as musicians seriously, but I think that, yeah, as a human being, I'm just one of the people on the planet, and I'm doing what I can to try and explain the connections I feel like I've made in my brain. Music's one of the best way to do that, for sure.
I guess you find that being a musician, the world around you can be all encompassing and want to take away your sense of music and, you know, sense of connection. That's one thing I notice about your gigs, that there's definitely a sense of connection with the audience.
I'd hope so. Yeah, for sure.
I'm interested. You know, you mentioned this earlier that you're being sort of quite systematic in keeping your options open.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting move when you released your Jesse series of albums.
Yeah.
I'm interested because you can sort of see different albums in that series have different focus.
Yes.
Was that apparent to you at the very start? Is that why you decided to do a 4-volume set?
It was. I knew one thing for sure when I finished my first record in my room, named after the song by the Beach Boys, and Brian passed away just a few hours ago, so it's worth saying his name. I knew that I wanted, having done that solitary mission, I knew I wanted to collaborate, but I didn't want to over congeal the record. I didn't want it to be one record that was so stuffed full of ideas that there was no coherence. So the initial idea was to create these four spaces for different kinds of sound to live. So volume one was quite a quite an orchestral album, so it's like a big acoustic sound, like an uncontainably large sound. Volume two was more of an intimate acoustic sound, more smaller scale. Volume three was my COVID record, so it ended up being quite negative, spacey and electronic, digital, experimental, things like that. And you know, I didn't know what volume four was about for many years. I thought, I don't know, I'll leave it till the end. I'll have an idea. You know, after COVID, I was a little stumped on it because I had so many ideas, but there wasn't a focus. And then I went on tour in 2022 and I came here to Australia and I did a concert at the Enmore Theatre here in Sydney. And we did something with the audience choir in that gig that really changed the gravity of the record, actually. I've been recording audiences throughout the year and just beginning to get just, you know, obsessed with this concept of the choir. And so I'd reckoned by that point that I might be able to focus the record about just the idea of the human voice. But I didn't have a first song. But I had an idea for something I could try with the audience where they sang a massive chord. They sang a big D major chord. And then I asked them to sing the note that was furthest away from the note in the D major chord. And it was this really chaotic kind of like white noise sound. And then I glided that first note. Well, they glided that first note from that first chord to the second chord. And by the time we got to the second chord, it was this D major. But it's like that famous THX theme. Kind of goes, you know. And that opens the record. And that was a huge moment for the album. And I really realized the power of the voice was actually my original love as an artist. It was the thing that got me into these a cappella arrangements that I put onto YouTube that it was my first contributions. And so it made sense to me to finish Jesse Volume 4 with the human voice. But I just didn't think it would get to the scale that it got to. And in the end, there were 100,000 voices on the album, more than. And that was a crazy feeling.
I'm interested in some of the arrangements on the album. I was listening to some. I'm wondering whether, you know, you've got so many collaborators. And did you fashion your arrangements and vocal arrangements after they'd done their performances around what they'd done? Or did you present them with your tracked stuff? I'm guessing you're going to say it varies. Right?
It varies, yeah. For sure. Yeah, I mean, with something like Bridge Over Troubled Water.
That's the one I'm thinking of, yeah.
Yeah. I found this video of Yebba singing Bridge Over Troubled Water online. It blew my mind, you know, and I thought, I'd really love to harmonize this just for fun. So I did so in 2021, and I released a little video, and people really responded to it. And then I was harassed, you know, properly harangued to be like, finish the arrangement. And I wanted to do it, but I wasn't sure how it was going to happen until the 11th hour of Jesse Volume 4. And I realized that my ideal scenario would be to highlight two other vocalists that I love and respect. And John and Tori came to mind as two titans of their craft, but two very different vocalists and also very different from Yebba, but they have a lot in common in a sense. They have a real sense of groundedness, a sense of soul, a deep technical proficiency of their instruments, and I just loved them most of all. So I asked each of them to sing their rendition of the verse, and John I said, you know, you do whatever you want. I'd heard him sing the song before. I know he can sing the hell out of that song, so he did what he does best. And with Tori, I had quite a specific thing in mind. I wanted to do it an emotional thing at the end of that song where it goes through a few keys. And so I ended up kind of recording this pseudo kind of impression of what she maybe would do. But it was half a joke because it's kind of unsingable. But then she went ahead and sang it.
She sounds amazing.
She sounds amazing. And she is, you know, one of my most favorite, most treasured friends and collaborators in the world. And she has that way of rendering something that's so kind of so complex as a harmonic navigation, as just completely natural, completely soulful, and then I was able to realize the kind of harmonic dream around that I'd first imagined. But there are other songs on the album where I very much completely left the collaborator to their own devices and then responded to that. You know, an example of that would be a song called A Rock Somewhere, where I recorded Anushka Shankar, the great sitarist, daughter of Ravi Shankar. She wrote this incredible melody to go alongside the song that I'd written that I got to sort of color in with my harmonic and sonic coloring pencils, and that was really fun. So I've learned so much from these four albums, but I think one of the things I've learned most keenly is how different my approaches are required to be for me to be a successful collaborator, in the sense of making something that's meaningful for everybody.
Yeah, wow. And there's so many people involved on that album. It must have taken a long time, right? Getting all that together. Wow.
4 years, really, of that album's creation from start to finish.
Yeah.
Everyone from orchestras. There's the Metropole Orchestra on the album, conducted by my mother, Susie Collier, which is an amazing full circle, because my first memories as a child were of watching her conduct orchestras. You know, when I was 2, 3, I'd watch her conduct, and it completely blew my mind at that age. And then there are, you know, there are choirs involved, even besides the audience, and there's collaborators from all continents. You know, there's a K-pop group called Esper, Colombian legend called Camilo. There's Shawn Mendes, Chris Martin, and we've mentioned Tori and John, but Michael McDonald's on the record, yeah. And Brandon Carlisle's on the record, and
that's a really real mixture.
And a mixture of generations too. Mm-hmm. And so I was just so excited to do something. It's such an ambitious thing, really. It was kind of ludicrously so, but I knew there was a way, or I hoped there was a way of making all these different voices around the world really feel coherent, and that was the goal.
And what's next? I mean, you've someone who could do an enormous amount of different things. I mean, I'd love you to do an album of solo piano improvisations. You could do another vocal album.
That is on the cards. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I'd love to hear it. So many. Me too. But how do you pick? I mean, do you feel there are limitations, or do you feel things that you wish you could do that you can't? I mean, I'm just interested how you make the next choices.
Do you know what is interesting about this time for creative people is I genuinely think, and this also goes, you know, within the dawn of AI, the only limit to the things we make are the things we can imagine. And the limits are how big are the questions that we can ask of ourselves. And so it's a really crucial time for people to make things. That's one thing I would just say overarchingly. And I think that the more diverse the things that people make are, the more interesting the time is that we're going to have. Personally, one thing I've never experienced, which I would really like to challenge myself to, is the limitation of a single instrument, which is something you mentioned. I don't know whether that will be the guitar or the piano or the voice or something else, but I'm very, very intrigued by the kinds of stuff that will get out of me, you know, because I can't out Multitude Jesse Volume 4. It's the biggest thing I could imagine making. And so I think it feels like the logical next step will be to really hone a particular aspect of a particular instrument and see where that takes me. I've always wanted to make a solo piano album. I'm confident that will happen in the next few years. And I, you know, grew up listening to solo piano records, and they changed my life. Listen to Keith Jarrett's Facing You, for example, or Bill Evans Alone, or all these things that really tickled my fancy in a deep way. So I'd like to do that. I'd like to really invest some time in the piano and make sure I'm thoroughly living in it, because it's easy living the kind of life that I live now to sort of whiz bang and wallop around all these instruments, and I have very intimate relationships with each of them. But I feel like that feels like the next step to me is to really zone in on particular crafts and enjoy them for what they are.
It's like an exercise in self-control, but not.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Well, I think there's actually infinity to be rendered out of anything. Mm. You can get infinity out of infinity, but you can also get it out of finity. And so that feels like an interesting next thing to explore.
I'm really interested too in your early years. You know, you sort of burst on the scene, and you know the story of Quincy Jones discovering you, and things happened pretty quickly. What was your gigging experience before that?
Oh man, I had a really interesting time touring at the beginning, because my first official gig was as Jacob Collier, was the Montreux Jazz Festival opening for Herbie and Chick, and it like wasn't. It's like you can't make it up. It was just
heavy
insane.
Enough. Yeah,
it was just wild. I couldn't believe it, and that was Quincy who opened that door. You know, so. And my second gig was in Brazil. My third gig was in London. My fourth gig was in a Java Jazz Festival, Indonesia. Then I went to Japan. Then I went to Prague. It was very bizarre. You know, a lot of artists hone their craft, you know, on the local scene, you know, playing little rock clubs or whatever coming up. But I was kind of catapulted into a very global stage.
Yeah.
So, you know, Australia, for example, was already on the cards within the first 6 months of my shows.
Yeah.
And then when I began to tour, you know, that's where I really honed the craft. And, you know, we did venues, 200 to 300, 400 person venues around Europe, around the States. I remember I came here to Sydney. I played a venue called the Metro, which was really fun.
I was there. Yeah.
You were there?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
And it was such an enlivening and sort of energizing time of my life. And I was learning so quickly. And I was so young. You know, I was only 21, 22 when I was doing that one-man show tour. And it was just like so... It was just so crazy to be in such far off climes and exploring in such deep ways, and since then I've updated the operating system, you could say, of the show a number of times. And the show I'm bringing this year to Australia at the end of the year is the kind of most up to date operating system I can think of, that incorporates all the kind of levity of the one man show and the freedom of the solo improvising world with the kind of electricity of a group of people. Plus the audience, which is obviously the other relationship I've been evolving over the years, and I'm so excited about this show. It kind of tickles all of the ticklables for me, ever since I first came here, I've always wanted to play, you know, these big arenas, and it's just wildly exciting to get to do so.
Was it hard for you to choose musicians? Like you know the bar's pretty high for you, so it's like, you know, how do you go about that?
It's a great question. It's funny, you know, touring, anyone who's toured will know this, but it's, you know, 95% hang, you know, and 5% jam. Mm-hmm. So it comes down to the quality of the human beings. I've got a lot of people in this band I've known for many years. Christian, the drums, I've known for many years. Robin, I've known for even longer, the bass player. Ben Jones, I've known for a while. Erin's one of my oldest friends. Erin's the vocalist and keyboard player. And then Parajita, I actually met really recently. She's 20 years old. She comes from Nepal. Mind-blowing vocalist, incredible storyteller. And so, you know, this has kind of evolved over the years, and there's few different outfits, but this current iteration is quite extraordinary. And I always try and surround myself with people who I'm going to learn something from too. You know, so like, you know, Robin, for example, was my hero as a kid. He's my absolute bass playing hero. He kind of still is. And I feel just through osmosis, I've become a way better bass player from hanging out with him. You know, yeah.
I guess that's the whole idea, isn't it? Just get better and better.
Kind of, yeah.
What was the progression of instruments that you learned? Like, where did you start?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first real center of gravity was the piano. You can kind of, well, you can just learn so much from the piano. You can be a drummer and a bass player and a harmonist and a melodist and all these things. So I hung out there a lot, but I didn't learn classical piano. I learned by ear, and I absorbed as much as I could from all sorts of different kinds of music, including classical music, and really just sponged up as much as I could. I was also singing from, you know, day dot, and it felt like a natural extension of my humanity is to be like, well, of course I'm going to sing. It's like, it's what we do. And I grew up singing in my family, and I've got two little sisters, and single mum raised us, so we would sing Bach chorales, SATB. My mum sang tenor, nice and low. So that was a real education in voice leading and in all of that at an early age. But I learned really intuitively. I didn't even consider such a thing as music theory until I was, you know, in my mid-teens, and even then I was a little kind of disillusioned with it. I thought, oh, this is so dry. The way I'm being taught this is so dry. But I was so interested in the concepts at play, you know, and the way of, you know, it's like studying science or physics or something. It's like zoning in and figuring out how to make these little chemical reactions, things that go bang in the brain. I think, oh, how did you make me feel this thing? Tell me, you know. And I would ask so many questions of the people I respected, and I would just ravenously absorb concepts to the point where I would learn a concept, and then I'd kind of break it. You know, I remember I learned the concept of the modes, you know, your major and minor modes, and I remember learning the concept of Lydian mode, and then realizing that actually when you get to the end of Lydian, you kind of want to keep being Lydian. You know, you kind of want to go like do 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 do. I don't know how much sense that makes to you listeners, yes. but basically the idea is that you can create this like super Lydian, super ultra hyper mega meta Lydian is the word I made up for it. The idea of kind of infinitely brightening, or you could say the idea of major being almost like a spectrum rather than a scale. It's like you can be increasingly major or increasingly minor, and minor is actually major upside down. And I got so interested in the almost like the sort of like philosophical underpinnings, the scientific methods, but never past the point that I was emotionally invested in the sounds. You know, I was so intrigued by how these things felt that every time I learned a new concept, it's like it would incorporate it into the emotional palette of the language I was using, and I'd find a way of making it give me goosebumps.
That's really interesting.
Fascinating.
I'm interested too in aspects of music theory. I mean, from what I understand, you're not reading music a lot, right?
No, not much. I mean, if I'm writing for a choir or an orchestra to play, then I'll write all the parts out in Sibelius or whatever it is. So I can do it, but I didn't learn instruments through reading. So, you know, if you put a Chopin prelude on front of me at the piano, I'd have a pretty hard time reading that through with my fingers. I could almost hear it better in my head than I could with my technique. But
so that means you must have to retain a lot of information in your head if your vocal arrangements where you've got 10 parts of vocals. Is that something that you increment by increment build them that way? Or
yeah, I'd yeah. say so. You know, I at the beginning I used to write them out when I was, you know, 17, 18, and then I realized, oh, I don't have to. It's just me singing this stuff. I can do whatever I want. Yep. So then I began to do a kind of mixture. I would preordain an amount of the arrangements by sketching things out, but a lot of it would just come to me as I was singing. You know, you sing, you know, 10 or 12 parts in, and then you hear a gap. Oh, I don't hear this gap. Let's try and fill that out. And all those decisions, all the choices you make, like, you know, whether to go ooh or or you know, you can't notate that stuff anyway. You know, notation is so crude.
Yeah.
So I found myself really getting inside the tonal differences, how much breath you put in a note, how much vibrato, you know, how many times I would layer a particular note up. All these choices come down to the intuitive relationships that are basically unnotatable.
Mm.
And then, you know, you can do a kind of reduction in notated terms, but I've never found it particularly helpful in really reckoning with what this music is saying.
Yeah.
Mm. We've got to wrap it up, but we could talk to you all day, especially about
likewise.
I'm sure you could talk about musical days which is what we do here on Blow.
Yeah.
But I've got one last question, and it's kind of a bit of left field, but if you woke up tomorrow and there was no humans here and then a new race of humans turned up, what would you tell them?
Well, I will say do it differently from the way we've done it in certain fundamental ways, but I think music is something I'd encourage. Though I don't think I'd need to, because I think it feels so inherent to us as linguists, as people who have evolved to create language. If it is indeed a race of humans, of you know, Homo sapiens in that way, I think music is inevitable. I think it will happen by itself. Mm. I'd maybe just, you know, I'd say, well, everything that we ever need is already here. We don't need to look outside of the planet and look outside of ourselves to find enough beauty to survive and build the things we need to build, but we need to take care of the beauty that's here better.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks.
Well, Jacob Collier, thanks so much for joining us, and you know, it's been a thrill to meet you and have chat about music, so hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Likewise. Thanks for your lovely questions.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Yeah. You have been listening to Eastside Radio Podcast. For selections of more enjoyable content like this, visit our website, eastsidefm.org, and click on Podcast.